This ROFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Hi folks, this is Richard Hall here from Stonehenge Aotearoa, and what we've got of course is our night sky that we'll be looking at the moment, and I've also got, as always, I've got Kay with me as well.
Hello everybody.
All right, okay, so we'll have a look at some of the exciting things that are happening in our night sky, and it is exciting because we live in one of the best places in the world to see the night sky. And when you do go out in a country area and you look up at those stars, the Milky Way, you've got to remember that only about 10% of the people on the planet have views like that. In most places, it's completely swamped out by city lights and so on. Anyway, let's have a look at what we've got coming up. And also, always like to thank Dan Broughton of YRF, a web design, who supports this program. It's very important. Okay, let's talk about Stonehenge itself. We're open from Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And that's when you can come out and just pay a small fee and you do a self-guided tour, isn't it, Kay? You get a map and an audio visual. And then take yourself around.
And I'd give a little, like, tell you how to have fun with the sound down at the Henge.
That's right. But we also do what we call guided tours, and that's when you get someone like me, it is normally me, who takes you on a tour around Stonehenge, but it's a tour into the past, looking at all the stories from antiquity and how these things worked and so on.
Okay, that's about 90 minutes. It can be made a bit shorter if, you know, that's a problem, but the standard tour is 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's, people say, oh, 90 minutes, it's a long time, but believe you me, they don't want to let Richard go. They'd keep him there all afternoon if they could.
But you do guided tours, of course, you do have to book in advance.
You can either, depending on how happy you are doing it through booking systems, you can either book through the booking system, or if it doesn't appear to have what you want, or you just don't like doing that, you can ring. And it's my cell phone you're ringing, so you're talking to me. Yeah. And I can do what I can to get things sorted out for you.
Now, the other thing that, we, of course, we can offer you is what we call a Star Trek. And to actually go around the night sky, we don't use big telescopes and things like that. That's something separate altogether. What we do is we've got an audio visual, a little short presentation, and then we take you underneath the stars and take you around so you can identify all the magnificent objects in the sky, which may be stars, planets, or whatever.
This is probably more like grandparents, great-grandparents would have taught you. But what you get in the audio-visual before, that's right up to scratch with the modern stuff.
Yeah.
But what you're doing outside with the laser light, that's how things were handed down.
It's the basics of learning your way around the heavens. All right? I always say it's a little bit like when you were a kid at school and you're learning the world and you're learning the map. And first you start off by identifying the continents, you know, Africa and India and so on.
It's actually very useful. Yeah. You might think that, you know, with our cell phones and things, you don't need all that stuff. But in actual fact, just to be able to look out and get your bearings and know whether you're heading north, south, east, west, you know, basically where you're going, that's a tremendous help.
But also, once you've worked that out, because as we move through the seasons, we get different stars and so on, amazing how quickly the brain gets used to that and you begin to identify different stars and things.
We are pattern machines. We like patterns.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So that's a Star Trek. But again, there's something you have to book, okay? Okay. There's been quite a few big meteors occurring recently. And on Tuesday, on July 28th, 10:30 p.m., we had this big meteor come over New Zealand. And unfortunately, I didn't see it because you've got to be out there at that moment to see it.
It's moving quickly.
Oh, yeah. But people all around New Zealand were talking about it because it just, for a short period of time, it turned the night sky into broad daylight as this thing crashed into the Earth's atmosphere. When first seen, it was 90 kilometres. We now know it was 90 kilometres above the Earth's surface and travelling at around about 14 kilometres per second. And it rapidly slowed to 2 kilometres per second at an altitude of 18 kilometres. Right. So these are some awesome things that you can actually see in the night sky. Unfortunately, in most cases, these things we cannot predict when they're going to occur. You just have to be out there at the time, don't you?
They look very big when you look at the light coming from them. But they're not as big as they look, are they, Richard?
Oh, no. No. I mean, most meteors that you see are about the size of a small pebble or a grain of sand.
It's a bit like a comet coming in with its halo around it.
Yeah.
As it's basically disintegrating and turning into vapour, which is actually lit up.
Yeah. Anything really big, of course, can actually survive passage through the atmosphere and actually ends up by hitting the Earth. And unfortunately, most of those have been swept up long ago.
Yeah, and some of them look just like the rest of our rocks, so I mean...
Because remember also, like, it was a meteorite that they believed for years no one could understand what happened to the dinosaurs. It suddenly vanished around the planet.
That was a pretty big one.
It was a meteorite, yeah. We'll have a look at those sorts of things later. Okay, so let's just keep an eye on, there's more and more occurring. Now, what they do know is this object we saw flash across the sky, its path tells them that it originated from the asteroid belt. And this is a field of debris orbiting around the sun in between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And to this day, people are not sure whether it's actually the remnants of a planet that never formed or possibly it's the remnants of two planets that collided.
The debris left over.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And they've got all their own orbits, because there's so many of them, every now and again one of them gets dislodged and it can at that stage fall in towards the solar system.
It can fall. It can be thrown out too.
Yeah, and eventually, with the passage of time, the Earth bumps into it, and that's when you get those big meteorites coming before. But the interesting thing is that what they're always interested in when those meteorites come in is to actually find the meteorite itself, because sometimes pieces of them are left over.
I think there was one that was seen and then found in New Zealand recently.
Yeah, yeah.
And quite often they're actually very heavy, aren't they, some of them? Not all of them. Yeah, they're all different ones.
Could be metallic as well. Mm. As I've just brought up here, they're relics. They've got an age of almost 4.6 billion years.
Which is why they want to see them, because exactly. They want to see what was around then.
They're the bits that left over when our solar system was formed. So, yeah, there's a lot of science and history tied into those stones. Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess if you've... had a look at the night sky at all. I know we've had a lot of rain lately. Like at the moment here in the Wairarapa, we're getting brilliant sunshine. And next moment, it's gone black and it's pouring with rain. And it goes back to sunshine again and so on. But if you do get a clear evening, you've obviously noticed this big bright star that you can see up in the sky. And you see that long before it gets dark and before you can see any other stars. And this, of course, is the planet Venus.
Which direction would you be looking in, Richard?
Well, at the moment, it's the evening star. We're looking towards the west. But you can't miss it. If you're looking up in the early evening when the sun's gone down, blue sky, it's the only star visible, you know. And it does shine out. It's very bright, yeah. So that's actually the planet Venus. And, of course, we only ever see Venus either in the morning sky or the evening sky. And the reason for that is that it's a planet, not a star, and it's closer to the sun than the Earth. Earth is, yeah. And that's the way in which it works. I just pulled up an image of Venus, and its current distance there at the moment is around about 105 million kilometres. And I always remember when I was a kid looking at Venus and so on, and the comics I used to have as well. And, of course, in those days, there were Martians and Venusians, right?
Mm.
In the science fiction stuff us kids used to get. The Martians always tend to be baddies and the Venusians tend to be goodies. I'm not quite sure why.
Because Venus was the god of war in the morning, wasn't she? And the god of love in the evening.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So there's a little bit of that stuck around. You also notice in those comets that the women were wearing hardly anything, Venusian women. The men were completely wrapped up in furs. So that tells you something about who's the tough ones, really. It's the women.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, Venus was always a world that You know, we just fascinated by it. But the trouble is, when we look through a telescope at it, I've brought up an image of a photograph of Venus, you can't see the surface of it. And because it's perpetually covered in clouds. And people always wondered what was beneath the clouds. Were there dinosaurs or something like that? You see, because in the ancient world, I would say ancient world, a few decades ago, when we didn't understand nuclear energy, it was believed the sun was simply, the energy came from gravity, and the sun was gradually contracting, releasing energy. So the idea was that the sun was originally much brighter than it is now, and it's slowly cooling down, right?
It's the other way around.
It is the other way around, yeah. We'll have a look at that at a later stage. But it was believed, well, that Mars would have developed before us. That's why Martians were always more advanced than us. But Venus was more primitive, and therefore you had dinosaurs.
People tend to think, when they see clouds, they tend to think of the clouds that they know.
Yeah.
So if you had really thick clouds, then maybe you could have a really tropical world underneath it.
That's right, yeah. Well, when we eventually did manage to send a probe to Venus, that went through the atmosphere and it stopped sending back signals. So we sent another one. And it did exactly the same thing. Then scientists began to realise there was something, a bit of a problem here. So eventually they sent an armour-plated spacecraft to Venus. And then when they landed at the surface, they discovered a world which is the nearest thing to hell that you can imagine. I brought up a photograph of the Venusian surface there. And, well, first of all, the reason why it didn't survive very long, the first one, is because the atmospheric pressure is 90 atmospheres. Pressure of 90 atmospheres, your car or anything else would just crumble and be squashed absolutely flat on the floor, right? And that pressure. Furthermore, its temperature at the surface was 465 degrees Celsius, hot enough to melt lead and so on, tin and lead.
And melt your car as well.
Yeah. Furthermore, those clouds, many of them were actually of sulfuric acid.
So you get frizzled, squashed and dissolved.
Not a nice place to be, all right?
Mm.
So that's what they discovered. So it's the nearest thing to hell that you could imagine, all right? And, yeah.
It's probably a bit hotter.
Yeah. Yeah, completely opposite. And carbon dioxide, you've got to remember, is a greenhouse gas. So if you've got CO2, what will happen is with the passage of time, heat that gets there gets trapped, and so the temperature gradually rises and rises. And that's why all the time people are talking about global warming, because human beings are releasing a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere.
And the thing about global warming is you're providing more energy, so everything becomes more violent.
Now, this hell, however, we'd known from spacecraft, was not always. Once upon a time, we now know Venus was very much like the Earth today. Continents, valleys, and almost certainly lakes and seas of water and so on. That's how it used to be. But because of the sun is gradually increasing brightness over millions of years, it got hotter, and eventually you reach a tipping point where they talk about the runaway greenhouse effect. Because as water boils away, the CO2 gets left in the atmosphere, which in turn traps the heat, and the planet gets hotter and hotter. So you start off with a planet like the Earth, and you end up with...
You get to the point where you can't stop it.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Now I've brought up a photograph of the planet Earth. And this is exactly one of the things that we're worried about today. We started off with a small population of a few hundred thousand people, you know, going back a relatively short period of time, less than a million years ago. And now our numbers are measured in the billions, aren't they?
Mm.
And this species that's on there is burning, cutting all the forests down. Is burning, releasing all the CO2 into the atmosphere.
Well, the forests are burning in Europe.
Yeah.
I mean, if some idiot started them, okay, but you are getting some of them burning just from, you know, lightning and I don't know. They're so dry, so hot.
People say global warming is not, a real thing. Hey, you can't cut down or burn most of the world's forests and burn all this stuff and think you're not going to have an effect on the atmosphere.
You think how many fires that is? You're talking about the problem with people burning fires in their home. That would be a problem. Or burning coal. But when you look at the fires in Europe and England and places that have never had them, well, and we're talking about us too later, we just happen to be in the opposite season, then you are talking about vast amounts going into the atmosphere.
Well, okay, I remember when I was a kid, I come from England originally, and in the winter it was always fire, you know, but there used to be a coal fire, you know, and wooden coal. But
I'll tell you what, didn't
we used to have these terrible smogs which were produced. And people used to die in their thousands, not from the cold, but from this smog that was created by all these fires.
Damaging their lungs.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Mm. I remember all those sorts of things well, you know. And when we were as kids, we wouldn't go out without we'd have special masks to put on and so on. We don't want to create a worldwide situation like that. And if you create that runaway greenhouse effect where once the water begins to evaporate, you reach a tipping point where more and more CO2 goes into the atmosphere as water boils and so on. Then you turn the beautiful Earth into something a little bit different, nearest thing to hell you can imagine. Right? So human beings often don't tend to do things until a crisis has already occurred, right?
Yeah.
And we find that with wars and all sorts of things, world wars and so on.
The crisis is occurring now.
Because once the runaway greenhouse effect takes over, there's no stopping it, okay? So we have got to do something about it now. Okay. Now we're back looking at the night sky. And, of course, this time of the year, when it is nice and clear, we get the most fabulous night skies, with the most brilliant region of the Milky Way coming overhead. In the night sky also, we are going to see the planet Saturn rising up in the early evening, around about 10 p.m., all right? And it's in the constellation of Pisces.
It's the fish.
That's the fish. Or the fishes.
Fish, two fishes, yeah, sort of, yeah, with a string
and
between.
At this present time, the distance to Saturn is 1.32 billion kilometres. Right, and it's not easy to pick out because unlike Jupiter, which is so bright, it's brighter than any other star in the sky, or Venus and so on, Saturn is a bright star, but it's no brighter than a lot of the other stars in the sky at the time. The only way you notice it's a planet is after a while, over weeks, it tends to change its position as it's slowly moving. Yeah.
The wandering stars.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, now, first of all, also, when we always go out at night, the first thing we do is a bit of navigation, working out where we are. So the first thing we have to do is identify the Southern Cross, which is always in the sky when the sky is clear. All right? I hope you can all pick it out now. There it is there. That's the Southern Cross. And we always know it's the Southern Cross because it's followed by two stars called the Pointers, right? Which is just above them. There they are there. And it follows the Southern Cross around the sky. Now, what you do is look at the Southern Cross and then take a journey through the cross to another star. Dead easy to pick. That star's Achenar. It is the only bright star in that region of the sky. So you've got the Southern Cross and Achenar. Come halfway in between and you've got the South Celestial Pole. That's the axis of the Earth projected into space. The entire heavens appears to rotate around that spot. And because Achenar and the Southern Cross are a certain distance from there, they never set. They go down near the horizon and then rise up again, while other stars beyond that horizon set. Okay, so there's the South Celestial Pole. Drop from that horizon down and you come to you're looking absolute due south, all right? So there's your coordinates, all right? Dead easy to find, to find your way around. So that's the Southern Cross using that. Also, at this time of the year, the second brightest star in the sky is close to the horizon, near that point in the south, and it's Canopus.
And Canopus is still used for voyaging out into outer space.
Yeah.
It's one of the stars they have to lock on to. They have to lock on to three to get your exact point,
yeah.
And that's one of them.
Well, when Canopus gets higher in the sky and is easier to see, we'll do a little bit of a story on Canopus, yeah. Okay, then turning back round to the north is what we were looking at earlier on, and overhead we've got the Scorpion. Dead easy to pick is a scorpion there. And its tail wraps around or closest to the brightest region of the Milky Way. The brightest star in the scorpion, of course, is Antares. And when you look at it, it's got a definitely yellowy-orange colour. And this is because it's actually, unlike our stars, vary in brightness and temperature. And Antares is a lot cooler than our sun, and its predominant light is red and orange. So it's what we call a red supergiant. Supergiant because it is a gigantic star.
It's okay. Dying. It's in the last phases of its life, isn't it?
Well, bring up a photograph of the Milky Way, which was actually, this photograph was taken from here in the wire wrapper. That's what we're looking at. There's Antares. Right? Mm. And you see those dark areas there. They're not places where there are no stars. They're actually clouds of cosmic dust and gas. They're the raw material from which stars are formed. But when you look at it, most of the stars appear to be blue. And the reason for that is that the hottest stars in the universe are blue stars. Right? And because they're brighter than most other stars, they dominate what you look at. Right? Antares, on the other hand, is a much older star, as Kay was saying. And it was a time, one upon, it was a blue star. And it's evolved into a red supergiant. And it'd be an absolutely colossal star. Here's a picture of what it would look like if you were near it. Antares's luminosity, the amount of energy it sends out, is something like 76,000 times that of the sun. But it varies because this star gradually pulsates. And you actually notice that when you observe it over a period of time, the brightness of Antares varies, right? And its diameter is 883 times that of the sun. That's its average distance. So if you put the sun alongside it, and that's what it would like. It's like a little dot. So this is, you can see why we call this a red supergiant. Okay. But as I said, the realm of the giants, most of the stars that we see in the night sky are not the common or garden variety of star. They're giants. They shine out over vast distances. And it gives us an idea that all the stars are giants, like these blue giants and so on, but they're not. They're actually one in a million stars. Is that as bright as Antares or something like that, or those blue stars that you can see in the photograph there? Most of them are very, very different. Again, these blue giants are interesting in a sense, but they are also very dangerous. The energy coming from them, bulk of it's coming often in ultraviolet radiation and so on. So, and they often become unstable, and they burn their energy very quickly. They can be tens of thousands of times brighter than the sun, but in turn, their life expectancy is much shorter. Okay, so that's what we've got at the moment. So I just wanted to mention, to finish off with, Voyager 1, a spacecraft that we've sent out there. And it is the first man-made thing that has travelled beyond the solar system. So there's Voyager 1 there, and it's travelling outwards. It was launched on September the 5th, 1977. That's almost 50 years ago, 49 years ago. 50 years ago, this spacecraft was launched, and it's travelling outwards. And as I said, it is now the most distant object ever built by humans. On its journey outwards, it explored Jupiter and Saturn and sent back a lot of imagery to us. But it carried on moving and eventually to travel out of the solar system. Okay, in 2010, it crossed the heliopause. Now, this is a magnetic bubble. See, we've got this material that floods out from the sun, the solar wind, and it creates this bubble of material which then gets trapped by the magnetic fields near the edge of the solar system, all right? And in 2010, it crossed the heliopause. Now, this is seen often as the edge of the solar system, but it's right beyond the most distant planets such as Neptune and Pluto and so on. Right? So it already passed that in 2010. And the heliopause has a distance from here of, I've got two numbers down there because it's actually a zone, 120 to 150 astronomical units. Now, an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. So the nearest part of the heliopause is 120 times further away than the Sun is from the Earth, all right? And I've also put the size there, 18 to 22 billion kilometres. So you've got this heliopause out there. And as I said, it crossed this in the year 2010. Now, it's travelling currently at 60,713 kilometres per hour. That's almost 17 kilometres per second. And its distance on November the 18th this year, in the year 2026, will be one light day. Right. Now, we always use the term light year. That's the distance light travels in a year. Well, I'm afraid the spacecraft's got nowhere near that. Though it's an enormous speed, faster than anything you can imagine here on Earth, travelling at, 61,000 kilometres per hour. Is now going to reach one light day, right? Which is, as I've put up there, just under 26,000 billion kilometres away. Now, that might seem a vast distance, but even if it was heading towards another star, it wouldn't get there for another 4,000 years at this rate.
Well, if you think about them sending a message to it when they try to fix something on it, it takes 23 hours, isn't it, for it to get to the Voyager and 23 hours to get back again.
That's right, yeah. So it's very difficult to have a conversation with the spacecraft.
At the moment.
And it would be the same if we had people on board.
When it gets to one light day, it'll take 24 hours to get.
Yeah. Yeah.
Travelling at the speed of light.
Okay. Now, it's powered by a radioisotopic, a gold-plated copper record is in there. And it's expected, the energy stored in it is expected to operate into the years 2030s, right? That's a fair old distance away.
If you think about the power it's got, it's a lot less than your phone. It's really, really little. Right, yeah. So they have to keep turning instruments off because it's losing power all the time.
Yes, it's such a vast distance. And this is the last photograph seen. As it looking back towards the solar system, and you can see that part of that heliopause cloud that we were talking about, which is shining with all these beautiful colours. Okay? So I say, it's on its way out there, and by the time it gets to a light year or so, it's going to be thousands of years from now. I think about 2,000 years before it travels a light year. But it's still going to be travelling onwards and onwards, right? So it's the object which the human beings have created has got the greatest life expectancy, because millions of years from now, that little spacecraft is still going to be travelling out there.
It was really not expected to last much longer than its journey past the planet.
That's right, yeah.
They expected it to fade out around about then. And it is, it's still working.
So obviously the thoughts about sending something more. Anyway, having said that, I just remember that if you want to come out and see us at Stonehenge, open at the moment, Wednesday to Sunday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, and you can also book a guided tour with me, okay? Well, having said that, we say goodbye until the next thing that we'll have a look at. And we've got some interesting things happening out there, so we've always got something to talk about.